Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come in this hour, we've got a lot of quick conversations, as we usually do on our Friday News Buzz. We'll remember the life and of editorial writer and editor Gil Cranberg in just a few minutes. Also, reflections on the legacy of Stephen Hawking. IPR's Kate Payne, our Eastern Iowa reporter, with a number of stories in Iowa this week. But first, it's been a big week at the State House. Another big week, I should say. A controversial bill regarding energy policy in focus there, advancing in the Iowa House. Also, new majority leader after a video of Senator Bill Dix surfaced of him kissing a lobbyist in a Des Moines tavern. Joyce Russell is with us, IPR's State House correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Let's talk about the new Senate Majority Leader. We began the week with one. We have a new one. Tell us about Jack Whitfer.
Senator Jack Whitfer, he's a Republican from Ankeny. He's been in the legislature for 8 years. He had been serving. He's had kind of a fast rise to the Senate presidency, and now he has the top post of Senate Majority Leader. He is a graduate of Iowa State University, where he played football. He is an attorney at a Des Moines law firm.
So with the new Senate leader for the GOP, does this sort of wipe the slate clean, or at least give a new start? We have months in this cloud of controversy after in the wake of that $1.75 million settlement to Kirsten Anderson, the Senate Republican staffer who filed that lawsuit alleging sexual harassment. Does this turn a page in that?
Well, to some degree, it turns a page because the two top people who were involved with that are now gone, Senator Dix and his top aide, Ed Failor. They were under criticism from even members of their own party for the handling of the case. One of the sharpest criticisms against them was that they never did, to the end, denied that Kirsten Anderson was fired because she filed a sexual harassment claim. To the end, they maintained that she was fired for poor job performance, although a jury certainly agreed with her analysis of it. So they're gone. However, Democrats are not satisfied with the status of things. They say that Senator Whitfer and now the new Senate President, Senator Charles Schneider, should make things right. They have a continued complaint about that sexual harassment judgment because it's being paid by taxpayers. Senator Janet Peterson, the minority leader, proposed this week that they take Senator Dix's unused campaign funds, which are pretty hefty, and apply them to that judgment. That's not going to happen, but that's an indication that this is still a very sore point.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me that at a federal level, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that would require members of Congress to pay sexual harassment settlements out of their own pockets.
Right.
It's now heading to the Senate, I think, at a federal level. Would you think there would be support for this at a state level?
The Republicans have expressed no interest in that so far.
All right. Let's talk about the energy bill. We've talked about it a number of times, a controversial bill advancing concerning energy policy in the state. Give us an update on that, please.
Well, a big part of that bill has to do with Iowa's energy efficiency program, and they did come up with a compromise on that, although not enough to satisfy advocates for energy efficiency. The bill, currently people pay, you don't know it because it's not spelled out on your bill, but you pay a charge on your bill that goes into this energy efficiency pot, and then that's where the money for rebates and home retrofits and all of that comes out of. Currently, what shows up on our bill is as high as 5 or 6% or even more for big industrial users. This bill would cap that at 2%, which would sharply reduce the amount of money that's available for these energy efficiency projects. The compromise is that Initially, this bill would have given everybody the chance to opt out of that, to say, no, I don't want that charge on my bill. I don't want I already have an energy efficiency appliance. I don't want that charge. And there was pretty wide agreement that that would have really scuttled the program if people could opt out of it. So it's still it will still be required. It's going to show up on your bill now, so you know how much you're paying, but it's going to be capped at 2%.
Mm-hmm. Another part of that bill, we've talked about how utilities, the rates they charge us and how that is approved through the Iowa Utilities Board. Any change there in that?
Some changes. It's a very complex bill, and I couldn't tell you exactly what, but it's safe to say that the consumer advocate is still very concerned about this bill.
There's been a contentious bill moving through the Iowa Senate, which is described as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I'm seeing reports this appears dead. Tell us again, remind us what it was, and is it dead?
Well, that's the bill that would it addressed a specific situation, an Iowa couple who ran a venue business, and they denied service to a gay couple, and they were forced to pay a settlement in that case. They eventually their business finally they closed their business rather than comply with Iowa civil rights statutes. And this is a bill that would have made it harder for the state to come down on that couple or any couple like that. So it was, religious freedom against Iowa civil rights statutes. And as you and I think, have talked about, mm-hmm. the Iowa's business community just hated this bill. They say it makes it hard to make Iowa look like a progressive and welcoming place to welcome new companies, young employees, and so on. And so the manager of that bill said it was on the Senate calendar, but it would have had to get through the Senate and then over to the House and through a committee this week. But so it looked that was kind of hanging by a thread anyway. And then the manager of the bill said with what people are calling the distraction of Senator Dix, that did eat up a little bit of time this week. If nothing else, the Republicans had to meet and elect a new leader. I don't think that bill was in serious trouble. I think because of the business community's opposition, that bill was in serious trouble anyway.
Mm-hmm. And finally, tell us about yet another controversial bill known as the Fetal Heartbeat Bill. Remind us about that and where it is.
Well, that bill has passed the Senate. It's been in the House for a couple of weeks. The House leadership has been outspoken, saying that they are happy with the 20-week ban that they passed last year. The leadership did not express an interest in this much more, even more restrictive ban, essentially a 6-week ban on abortions. And yet there is tremendous pro-life a sentiment in the House. And so even though we had the leaders saying lukewarm things about the Fetal Heartbeat Bill, or more than lukewarm things about the Fetal Heartbeat Bill, the adamant pro-lifers are proceeding with it anyway. So it did pass the hurdle this week to get through the House committee. Now the question is whether the House leadership is going to let that come to the floor for a debate and a vote.
Mm-hmm. And if passed, this would be one of the most restrictive abortion bills, laws in the country, right?
Oh yes, and clearly the bait for a court challenge. Iowa's 20-week ban is at the moment tied up in court. It's before the Iowa Supreme Court right now.
Okay, IPR State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Thanks for now. We'll look forward to working with you on Monday, on the Monday legislative edition of this program. We'll talk about the so-called Sanctuary City Bill. Joyce, I look forward to working with you then and talking with you then.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's talk with IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter now. Kate Payne joins me to talk about some stories you've been covering. Hi, Kate.
That's right. Hey.
Let's talk first about, spring break this week. This meant that nationwide walkout of students to protest gun violence bypassed many Iowa students, but still there were demonstrations in a number of Iowa cities, Davenport, Council Bluffs, Grinnell, Dubuque, West Liberty, and also you went to a walkout in Fairfield, Iowa. What did you find?
That's right. So I went down to the Maharishi University of Management there in Fairfield. There was a small group of students who wanted to show solidarity with the victims and the survivors of the shooting in Parkland. And so there were actually at that walkout, there were staff members, a representative from the school security team, as well as some administrators. And it was a very subdued sort of experience for them. They just wanted to take a little time out of their day and dwell on these students. And I spoke with the student body president there, Chris Evergreen, and she said that something that's sort of striking the students there differently in Fairfield is there's a really strong international community, a lot of international students there at the university. And she says they're just not used to this. And we have a bit of audio here from her.
We have students from over 80 different countries here at our school represented at any given time, sometimes 90. And the international students, they don't really know what to think about it because they don't have mass shootings in their homes or their hometowns or in their schools. They don't have to worry about it. And they just are kind of taking it all in, like, this is what America's like. And then for the people who are from America, from the U.S., and used to it, they don't want to be used to it.
Okay. You spoke with Chris Evergreen, the student body president there. So as I mentioned, many Iowa schools did not, it sort of just bypassed them, the participation because of the spring break. But there is another demo planned for later in the month.
That's right. And that's being called the March for Our Lives. And so that's, again, organized by the Parkland students. That'll be on March 24th, again, meant to be a national coordinated movement with representation all across the country.
Kate, you've also been covering the Iowa angle of another national story, DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Under this program, unauthorized immigrants who were brought to the country as children are protected from deportation. Now, Donald Trump sent that to have an expiration date. That was to be March 6th. The courts held that up, and so it's kind of in limbo right now. But Iowa's Conference of Catholic Bishops is defending DACA, a program that is, as I said, on hold. You spoke with an Iowa priest to get his views. Who did you speak with?
Yeah, I went out to St. Patrick's Catholic Church here in Iowa City and spoke with Father Rudy Juarez there. And he's actually built a really strong Spanish language ministry at the church. It's almost like two separate congregations there, an English congregation and a Spanish-speaking congregation. And he says that congregants on both sides of that language divide are affected by this and are really trying to make a difference and trying to reach out to their elected officials. One of the first things you see when you walk in is a table of postcards ready to be sent to ICE and to members of Congress. He says that his parishioners, the ones who are part of the DACA program and their families and friends, you know, they're just being buoyed by these changes that keep coming, and it's difficult for them to know what the next day will bring. But he says he's really motivated by his Catholic faith to make room for these people, and he spoke to that here.
You know, it's not about saying that, no, you can't come to the table. It's about setting another place and putting a little more water in the soup. That's how we've always done it, and I think it's possible to continue that.
Father Rudy Juarez of Iowa City speaking to the Catholic bishops in Iowa, Iowa's Conference of Catholic Bishops defending the DACA program. Kate Payne, a couple of other things very quickly. A Burlington Clinic that will be opening, in June,
mm-hmm.
And this has some background, a new family planning clinic. Tell us about it and why it's notable.
Yeah, so last summer, the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Burlington closed. There are a number of clinics, Planned Parenthood clinics, that closed last year because of changes from state lawmakers and how those clinics get funding. And in that time, medical professionals in that area around Burlington have felt that there's really a need, and they were hoping that those patients would find services elsewhere, but
mm-hmm.
they're seeing that that's not happening in the way that they wanted to. So the hospital there, the Great River Health Systems, will be opening a new family planning clinic. And the billing there is going to be slated towards people's income. So it's supposed to be more affordable and really geared toward reproductive health care.
Mm-hmm. And then the politics of this, no abortion services.
No abortions, correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Planned Parenthood clinic before also did not perform abortions.
And finally, Kate, before you walk out the door, I have to remark that you're a new voice, a new name for Iowa Public Radio listeners, an official on the air. Welcome to Iowa Public Radio staff.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Tell us, listeners would be interested, a little bit about yourself. You come to us from Florida.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a North Florida native. I was at an NPR member station in Tallahassee before this, so a lot of state politics there. Did a lot of work on the environment and local government and healthcare and education, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So coming north to the Midwest, What sorts of stories are you most interested in covering?
Yeah, well, gotta say, politics in Iowa is sort of like a holy grail. Yeah, you know, it's terribly exciting for a reporter to be here at this time. You know, everybody watches Iowa, and I think it's going to be a really interesting couple of months leading up into the election. And it was really, I guess, persuasive to me to come to a place that has such a strong civic engagement culture.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, well, we've enjoyed your reporting so far in the first few days here at Iowa Public Radio. Perhaps you could tell us how Iowa Public Radio listeners can get in touch with you, perhaps with story suggestions.
Sure. Well, you can always go onto our website and keep track there, but my email is kpayne@iowapublicradio.org, and follow me on Twitter @HelloKatePayne, and please feel free to send out ideas and questions and all those thoughts.
Okay, Kate Payne, last name is spelled PAYNE.
That's right.
Want to remark on that. Thanks so much, Kate.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Gil Kranberg passed away on Sunday. He was 93 years old. Kranberg's career as an editorial writer and editorial page editor for the Des Moines Register spanned 33 years. He will be remembered as a bright, highly ethical newsman and for his work focusing on civil rights, inequality, and criminal justice. His daughter, Marcia Kranberg, joins me now from the place where he lived the last few years of his life, Sarasota, Florida. Marcia Kranberg, welcome to the program, and our condolences to you and your family.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Marcia, tell us, do you know why your father got into journalism?
Gee, that's a good question. He just had a very curious mind. He had an extremely intellectual father. He served in the infantry in World War II, and so at a very young age traveled to the Pacific, and where he participated in landings on Okinawa and Leyte. And I think that just sort of piqued his curiosity about the world. And he grew up in a very intellectual household full of books and conversation. His father was a very progressive man. And after the war, he returned to traveling and lived abroad in Hungary and Spain. So I think he just had an extremely curious mind and also was raised with a passion for justice and perhaps felt that journalism would be a vehicle to help him accomplish that.
Mm-hmm. He's not a native Midwesterner. He was raised out east in the Bronx, the son of Jewish immigrants to Ellis Island, I understand.
Yes, that's right. And he was one of three children, and his father actually became a civil engineer, which was rather unusual for a first-generation Jewish immigrant. And so my father grew up in the Bronx, attended the Bronx High School of Science, and once he got his education, he applied for journalism jobs around the country, and the Des Moines Register offered him a position right out of the gate as an editorial writer, which is rather unusual. Frequently, you have to work up to that. And so he grabbed that and didn't know anything about Iowa, but came out. Unfortunately, it was in December of 1949, so he saw Iowa at its worst. But he loved living there.
Right, the winter didn't scare him away. Thankfully for Iowans, all the tributes I see to your father applaud him for his extremely high ethics. One I noted was that after he editorialized for lowering the speed limit, this was after the first sort of fuel crisis in the 70s, lowering it to 55 miles per hour. He refused to drive over 55 miles per hour because he'd editorialized for that lower speed limit. Where did he get these high ethics? It must have been a tremendous power in your family being raised by such a father.
Again, I guess perhaps his own father, who was an unusual person. And in fact, I've been packing up my father's belongings the last couple of days, and it's shelves upon shelves of works of philosophy. And so I'm not really certain, but something in the way he was raised. He was raised in an immigrant neighborhood, a fairly poor neighborhood in the Bronx, and he just came by it naturally, I guess. I do have to say, I'm afraid I do recall his occasionally driving faster than 55 miles an hour, but perhaps not often.
All right. You know, he's being applauded for his professional achievements, but you as his daughter have, I'm sure, so many personal memories that you will cherish of your father. Can you leave us with a personal memory?
I think it would be just overall as kind of a role model, and I think it's really wonderful for kids to grow up in a household where the parent is somebody you truly admire, and I've just always admired my father very much, and he sort of had a combination of, you referred to him as being very ethical. He also was quite intellectual, and he was extremely modest and sort of unflappable. And then on top of all that, he just had a tremendous sense of humor. So the package was really a wonderful package to have as a child. His humor really just infused our household, and it imbued a lot of his writing. And in fact, just going through a lot of his papers, I see a lot of half-written nubs of ideas that had a lot of humor in them. I don't even know if they ever saw the light of day, but he was a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you so much for sharing and helping us remember someone who was really important here in Iowa for so many years. Gil Cranberg, dying on Sunday, editorial writer and longtime editorial page editor for the Des Moines Register, also taught at the University of Iowa School of Journalism later on in his life. Marcia Cranberg, his daughter, we want to thank you. And again, our condolences to you and your family on his passing.
Thank you very much indeed.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, reflections on the legacy of Stephen Hawking by University of Iowa astrophysicist Allison Janes. And we'll look at the race to run in the last dam to dam. That's when River to River's News Buzz edition continues. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week we know the world marked the passing of world-renowned theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking. Hawking, best known for pioneering new understandings of black holes and the universe, he'll also be remembered for how much one person can achieve. Hawking left behind this incredible legacy. It's really amazing when you think he is a person who struggled with ALS, a neurodegenerative disease that confined him to a wheelchair for most of his life. He died at the age of 76 this week on Wednesday, March 14th, notably Albert Einstein's birthday. Joining us now to reflect on his work, his teachings on space, time, and the universe, Allison Janes, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Allison, welcome back to our program.
Hi.
Let me just broadly ask you, what are your thoughts as the world honors this incredible individual?
Well, he certainly left behind quite a legacy, and I'm sort of very honored to have been alive at the same time as him and to have read some of the books that he put out and some of the theories that he put out sort of in real time. I think he'll be going down in the history books for sure.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, in layman's terms, we're very few of us are theoretical physicists. What are his biggest legacies in the field of physics?
So I think one of the biggest things he'll be known for is what we now call Hawking radiation, named after him, of course, and that was the theory that black holes do emit radiation. That was an early on theory of his, and it's certainly come to be known as one of his more foundational theories.
And previous to that, we thought nothing escapes a black hole. Right.
That's okay. Correct.
Okay, so Hawking radiation escapes. What else will he be remembered for in your field?
Well, he was always looking to find this unifying theory of cosmology. He wanted to get to the root of the universe, and so he did a lot of work combining general theory of relativity with quantum mechanics, and we haven't quite gotten there yet to this unified theory, but if we do, it will be him that laid some of that groundwork for sure.
Mm-hmm. You say you feel lucky that you lived at the same time that he did. I wonder, Allison, as an astrophysicist, did he shape your life, your calling in any way?
He did. I remember coming across an old dog-eared paperback copy of The Brief History of Time, his popular science book when I was in high school, and it really did change my thinking in terms of opening up that world to someone who didn't have the scientific knowledge yet to understand it, but could understand it in the popular science terms that he laid out.
Mm-hmm. He's also known in popular science, popular culture as well. Let me get into that just a moment with your thoughts. Stephen Hawking, the only person ever to appear in an episode of Star Trek as himself. Here's a clip from that episode from Star Trek, The Next Generation. He's playing poker in this scene with Sir Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein, and Data. Of course, that's the android who is part of the Starship Enterprise's crew. They are all three on the holodeck. This is Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein, Data, along with the real Stephen Hawking.
But then I said, in that frame of reference, the perihelion of Mercury would have processed in the opposite direction.
That is a great story.
Quite amusing, Dr. Hawking. You see, Sir Isaac, the joke depends on an understanding of the relativistic curvature of space-time. If two non-inertial reference frames are in relative motion...
Do not patronize me, sir. I invented physics. The day that apple fell on my head was the most momentous day in the history of science.
Not the apple story again.
That story is generally considered to be apocryphal.
What? How dare you?
Perhaps we should return to the game. Hmm?
Albert Einstein, Data, Isaac Newton, and the real Stephen Hawking. So, jokes aside, does he belong in a way next to these great figures, Albert Einstein, Isaac Newton, in the physics pantheon?
I think so. I do. And, you know, he, again, had a great sense of humor, you could tell from that scene. And he also made an appearance on The Simpsons at one point as himself. So he was sort of a real relatable person at the same time as a great genius.
Mm-hmm. He also had warnings. This was more recent from a BBC interview from 2014, warning about artificial intelligence, how it could be dangerous. Here's part of what he said.
The primitive forms of artificial intelligence we already have proved very useful. But I think the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. Once humans develop artificial intelligence, it would take off on its own and redesign itself at an ever-increasing rate. Humans, who are limited by slow biological evolution, couldn't compete and would be superseded.
Okay, a warning from Stephen Hawking from 2014 via a BBC interview. I wonder, Allison, if you share this, most of us are with very elementary, if you could even call it artificial intelligence, with, I don't know, Google Home or Echo, Alexa, or, you know, asking Google this or that. But he says, could spell the end of the human race. Do you share his concern about artificial intelligence?
Well, maybe not from Alexa herself, but certainly there is that fear, and I think a lot of people are looking into that more. You know, there was an increase in this kind of technology, and now there's a step back and a look at the ethics and what the consequences could be, and that might be due in part to some of these early warnings from Stephen Hawking.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe in this principle? And people, the buzzword here is singularity, that at one point we do create artificial intelligence that overtakes us. I guess that's the point of singularity. Do you see that as the danger point?
It's very hard to say, since we are just, I think we're just putting our toe in the water as far as this kind of technology goes. So going forward with caution into such a new world is always a good idea.
Mm-hmm. You know, Stephen Hawking was remarkable in that, you know, he was robbed of his movement very early on in his life. In 1974, he started to use his wheelchair full time. In 1985, he lost his ability to speak and begins using a machine to talk for him. Allison, I wonder if your thoughts on how these disabilities shaped him, perhaps allowed him to inhabit a world that able-bodied people could not.
You know, everybody who faces challenges that might be different than his or the same or prejudices has to always work a little harder, be a little more dedicated, and find a little more passion in their life for what they're doing in their work. And I think it undoubtedly shaped the way that he approached his life and his work.
Allison Jane says, an astrophysicist, have you been marking this anyway with your colleagues and discussing it, the passing of Stephen Hawking and his legacy?
Oh, of course. It's been a constant topic of conversation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Allison Janes, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Allison helping us mark the passing of the world-renowned theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking, who was born exactly 300 years after the death of astronomer Galileo and died this week on Wednesday, March 14th. Albert Einstein's birthday. Thanks, Allison.
Thank you.
And we're finishing up our news buzz, a handful of conversations to end the week here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's go to this. A controversial work by Iowa artist Grant Wood to be on display as part of an exhibition opening at the end of this month at the Des Moines Arts Center. Joining us to tell us about it, Jared Ledesma, an assistant curator for the Des Moines Art Center. Jared, welcome to the program. I hope I got your last name right.
Thank you. Yeah, that was right.
Okay, very. Jared, the exhibition called Sultry Night, Selected Works by Grant Wood, running through from March 30th through June 24th of this year at the Des Moines Art Center. Tell us a little bit about the focus of this exhibition, Sultry Night.
Sure. So the Whitney Museum of American Art, right now, they're mounting their own Grant Wood exhibition. It's a very large-scale retrospective of his work. And the Des Moines Art Center, we lent one of our prized paintings by Grant Wood, The Birthplace of Herbert Hoover, to that show. And so we were kind of thinking, well, you know, if the Whitney's doing their own show, we should do ours, because he's Iowa's guy. And in our collection, we have some great lithographs by the artist, 19, which is all the lithographs he produced throughout his career. And I don't think they've ever been shown together. And we also have his early Impressionist paintings that I don't think many people know, that we have about 5 in our collection, and that he worked with Impressionism. So I really wanted to bring them out of storage and show them together. In regards to Sultry Night, that story is just really fascinating, and it piqued my curiosity. So there's one lithograph in particular. Its title is Sultry Night, and it was produced by Grant Wood in 1937, and it features this nude farmhand bathing at a trough by moonlight, and it's pretty seductive if you think about the time period. And he's holding this pail of water over his head, and the water's just falling onto his body, and it's a little sensual,
right? And it's what we call sometimes artistically, the subject is posed as to not exposed. Let's say this is full frontal nudity.
It is, and you know, artists at the time they would when they would depict the male nude, it would be very academic. So with Grant Wood taking on this very realistic depiction of a nude male, was pretty radical at the time. So radical that the post office, the print was sold through the mail, and the post office considered it pornographic, and they refused to deliver it. And the image was barred from being illustrated in these mail order catalogs. So then, you know, during the same period when he was producing this lithograph, he actually was also working on a painting called Sultry Night. And it was the same scene. We have the nude farmhand bathing at the trough. And when he unveiled the work at his home in Iowa City to some close friends, it was, the story goes that it was the men in the room that were really embarrassed by the painting and not the women. But, you know, Grant Wood, he really trusted in this painting, and he actually sent it to a juried exhibition, the Carnegie International in Pittsburgh, which at the time was a renowned, it still is, but at the time it was a renowned exhibition for international contemporary art. And they rejected it. They didn't want to hang it on their walls. So when it came back to Iowa City, Grant Wood, in order to kind of, I think, to kind of save the work, he sawed off the portion of that featured the nude male, and he burned it. And it sat in his studio for a little while until a close family that he had known through childhood, they contacted him, and they were in Madison, Wisconsin, and they purchased the work from him. And it's been in Madison, Wisconsin since that time, so over a half a century.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left, Jared. I think you would agree we have to mention or remind us of Grant Wood's sexuality here. That's the topic of a lot of biographical info on this
right.
man. Yeah,
right. Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to pin it down because there's no factual evidence, and he was very ambiguous. But I'm really happy with the scholarship that's kind of bringing this to light, this questioning about his sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. So this is just one of the works, Sultry Night, selected works by Grant Wood. With the suite of 19 lithographs, you say?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And yes.
Yeah. Okay. It sounds like there's some wonderful stories behind a lot of these works. Thanks for sharing that one with us. Jared Ledesma, Assistant Curator for the Des Moines Art Center. And as we said, this opens March 30th, runs through June 24th. It will be a nice thing for us to get out to see.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jared. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, June 2nd will mark the 39th and the final, it seems, dam-to-dam race in Des Moines. Let's talk about it with the race director, Kurt Schaefer. Are you there, Kurt?
Good afternoon, Ben. I am here.
Good afternoon to you. So it was quite a surprise this week when registration opened up for dam-to-dam. What happened?
Well, we were very, very surprised how the registrations really took off. We had a little ceremony down at the finish line at Cowles Commons in Des Moines, Iowa. It started at 6 o'clock. We had about 100 participants show up where they could get we had some free drawings for fitness sports gift certificates and running apparel from that had dam logo on it. And at 6:20, we checked Get Me Registered, and we had over 2,200 entrants already. We were just totally shocked by that number.
You've been race director for some 20 years. You've been involved, I think, for three decades. This is unusual.
Yes. Yes, it is. Our 35th anniversary, 4 years ago, we had a good turnout. Registration was capped at 9,000. We filled that, but it took a longer time than this year.
Mm-hmm. So you even opened up more spots because that sold out so quickly.
We did. We opened up another 1,000 spots and filled those up. So we had 9,000 registrations in a period of 7 hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
so
then,
we have some disappointed people out
right.
there. That,
do you know how many disappointed people who didn't get in?
We got a lot of emails, I'll tell you that. Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, what about opening some more spots?
Well, you know, the deal is that we start on a dam out of town, 12 miles out of town, and the dam is narrow. The roads to the dam are narrow. There's no parking up there, so all the runners have to be bused to the start point. And so that creates, you know, one problem of, you know, trying to increase the number of participants is how are we going to get all those runners up there? We've pretty much maxed out on the bus situation, getting the runners there. And then, of course, you know, having the course being able to handle that crowd, it's hard to believe that, you know, after running 12 miles, that the runners are still running in a mass of people.
Mm-hmm. And this is what, 8,000 runners?
Yes, we had 9,000 registrants. We'll probably have 8,000 that finish. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to do, we are working with Get Me Registered, which is our registration site, third-party service we use. And we're working with them to see about how we go about, get the mechanics down that if a runner can't participate and, you know, wants to transfer their number to another runner, we're going to get that worked out. There's just a few details to go over.
So are you maybe creating a wait list? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we're not quite creating a wait list. We don't want to get involved with the mechanics of it, you know, creating a wait list and because we're all volunteers. We all hold jobs, you know, full-time jobs. So it would be somebody that, gee, you know, a runner who injured themselves possibly, and they say, hey, I'm not going to be able to run, but, hey, I can transfer my my number to you, my race number to you, to another runner in his group, you know, and they can handle it between the two of them.
Right, Kurt, we're running out of time here. We've got to get to the real nugget here. Why, after 39 years, is Dam to Dam ending this phenomenal race that's known far and wide?
Well, the reason is that we have kind of a well mature committee. We have two people on the board of the committee, and they do a lot of work that have been on the race committee for all 39 years. Myself and another person have been on it for 36 years. So, as we looked at it, and we're a nonprofit, all volunteers, as I mentioned, it's hard to find people who want to continue and put in the amount of work that a number of people have done through the years. So we knew that, hey, whoever wanted to take it over most likely would want to be a for-profit. That's the way runs have gone. They started out in the 1980s, small runs. Put on by runners, and it has evolved where it's now really a business, people making a profit. So that would drastically change the dynamics of Dam to Dam that we've had for the past 38 years.
Okay, Kurt Schaefer, race director for Dam to Dam for some 20 years. Well, thanks for the comment about it. So we'll see what happens. The final Dam to Dam, as it has been known, June 2nd, it's the 39th one, just shy of 40 years, Kurt.
39 forever.
Thanks for sharing with us, Kurt.
Thank you, Ben. It was good talking to you.
All right, good talking with you. Kurt Schaefer, ending our program, except for, well, we've got to chill out as news junkies, you know. It's a good antidote for getting perhaps a little, I don't know, do you get uptight about the week's news? Sometimes I do. Everybody does, I think. Tony Daner is with us at Iowa Public Radio Studio One. He's a host there delivering all that wonderful Studio One music. Tony, you guys in Studio One, you never get bothered by the news, do you?
Oh, well, no, because we're constantly in a state of chill with all this great music we've got on Studio One tracks.
And that's why we turn to you to groove into the weekend. What do you got to groove into the weekend as we end the work week?
Sure. This week it's Shannon and the Clams, great band from Oakland, California. The way I would describe them is they've taken a lot of classic styles and kind of thrown them into a blender and come up with something just, I mean, it's not super original, but it sounds like them, you know, if that makes sense to you. And this is the band's fifth album. It's called Onion. It was produced by Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys, who is one of the busiest people in music these days.
Okay.
And this song is called The Boy.
Okay. Tony Daner, thanks. Grooving into the weekend. Make sure you do tune into Iowa Public Radio Studio One service over the weekend. It makes your weekend so much nicer. Thanks, Tony. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.